What's the 411? You're tuned into 411 Teen, a weekly program for teens and other interested folks. 411 Teen provides a forum to examine and discuss various issues and events that confront, intersect, and sometimes interrupt our daily lives. I'm Dr. Liz Hollyfield, and joining me at the roundtable, I welcome Maria Vigilopas. She's a student at Florida State University. She's a junior majoring in psychology. Hello.
Hello.
Jorge Rendon. He is a student also at FSU. He's a sophomore in finance and applied economics.
Hello.
Alejandro Victoria, a junior in political science and Hispanic marketing.
Yep.
Okay. Wow. All right. And Jacide Acosta, he is a senior. He's in international affairs, finance, and education.
Hello. Thank you for having us. Appreciate it.
I look forward to talking with you. The Hispanic Latino Student Union is a student organization at Florida State University. It serves as a nucleus for a network with other national institutions and organizations to improve the opportunities and living conditions of Hispanic and Latino community. It also functions as an educational and cultural learning instrument for students, faculty, and staff. The organization is open and accessible to anyone. The Hispanic Latino Student Union centralizes coordination of resources and services for the Hispanic and Latino community. My first question is, please explain the difference between the terms Hispanic and Latino, and what is the appropriate use of each one?
I guess real quick, the Hispanic term is mainly used to describe just Spanish-speaking peoples. Whereas the Latino term is used to, like, also, it's more inclusive of Portuguese-speaking, French-speaking, basically all the ones that are kind of Roman descendants.
Mm-hmm.
That's the main difference. And they're used sometimes interchangeably, but that's
okay.
Basically it.
And Alejandro, you were saying something before we went on air about that, and I want you to share.
Yeah.
I want you all to share. This is educational for me and my listening audience, so I want you all to feel free to share everything that you possibly can.
Okay. One of my classes, U.S. Latino Literature, one of my professors did say recently to me that those terms, although they are interchangeable, that a lot of people academically – the term Latino is frowned upon. I mean, the term Hispanic is frowned upon,
okay.
And the Latino term is what is used academically to identify those cultures, because it's more than just a term that defines, you know, you and, like, this census thing.
Mm-hmm.
That's where the word Hispanic came from.
Mm-hmm.
But Latino is used more academically.
Okay. And the terms really refer more to a culture and an ethnicity as opposed to a race. It's not a race, right? That correct?
It's not really a race. And, mm-hmm. I think looking back at when they were used, I guess the word Hispanic was used in a census. So it was kind of like used more by the U.S. really. So like
mm-hmm.
in Latin America, actually, in the regional countries, you won't use that term as much. You will never – not as much at least. Recently, I think the influence has started. But the word Latino – was first used by Frenchmen in France, and it just became a way to just honor the Latin races,
mm-hmm.
guess. And since then, it just became more prevalent.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Okay. Let's talk about the organization. Tell me about it. I mean, and when I say about it, when do you meet? How does one join it? Just give us the whole scoop.
Yeah, so the Hispanic Latino Student Union is open to every FSU student. As long as you are a student at FSU and you pay ANS fees, you are a member of HLSU, since we are one of the five agencies on campus. And we really focus on bringing a home away from home to students that come from every area of the United States and who wants to study here at FSU. We really focus on creating a sense of, like, familia and making sure they're comfortable and they find a place where they can come and interact with other students who are similar to them, and to find a place where they can share their culture to students who might not know a lot about the Hispanic and Latino culture at FSU.
How does one contact you? I mean, you have a website or whatever.
Yes.
For someone who's listening and they might go, ah, yeah.
Yeah.
You know?
For sure. Yeah, we have Instagram, all kind of social media. We have a Twitter. We have a Facebook group, a Facebook page, which is HLSU at FSU.
Okay.
We also have a Twitter and an Instagram, and we have a page on the SGA website. If you go to sga.fsu.edu, you'll go to the agencies tab, and you'll find us there as well.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Now, what are some of the issues that you all address in your organization?
So we cover a lot of educational issues, such as the DREAM Act, immigration reform.
We're going to get into those.
Yes, we are.
Sure.
Yes, we are. We cover anything from, like, the LGBTQ community and the Hispanic community together to women's rights and other issues that affect FSU students specifically as well. So we cover everything that students want to listen to. We do El Centro Dialogues, which Jorge has done before with the agency. We do social events. We do networking events. This past February, we went to Uxley, the United States Latino, the United States Hispanic Leadership Institute in Chicago, and we took 16 students to the conference, and we learned a lot about leadership and things that we could bring back to FSU and educate our whole community on.
Is there any cost or fee involved in joining the organization?
No, not at all. You all pay that with your...
This is
with
too good to be
I know.
And you get to go on trips.
Yeah. And the trip was also sponsored by the agency as well. So students got to go for free.
Now, before we started the program, you all were just kind of talking about some of your experiences. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to ask you to share some of those with me and the listening audience. Whomever wants to go. Jorge. Yeah, we'll talk about Jorge because he does it called Jorge. And I remember that.
One of the things that I think would affect me the most was when I moved here from Ecuador at the age of 6, I was always called Junior by my family because my father's name is Jorge as well. And once I went to first grade in California, people just started calling me George because it was easier for them, and it just stuck to me, and I never really corrected them. It's something that I'm working on now. And I'm trying to make sure I pick one, which is why I'm starting to stick to Jorge. I have a friend of mine who last week was telling me that he was talking to me about other people.
Mm-hmm.
And then people were like, who's Jorge? Because they knew me as George. So it was kind of confusing. So I've decided to, you know, have to pick one and stick to one.
Yeah.
And that brings up a really interesting point that a lot of students who come, for example, me, I had no – I grew up in Orlando, for example, and I had – no connection really to the Hispanic or Latino roots that I had, being Mexican and having visited Mexico. I really didn't embrace it as much as before until I got involved with this organization, HLSU, more. And so I, in the same sense, also start embracing this culture, this way of, you know, being, and these issues as well.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Yes, I think I have a very similar case. I lived in Venezuela for 10 years, and I moved here when I was 10. And I had been almost living in the United States for as long as I lived in Venezuela. Mm-hmm. So I'm having that kind of like, okay, am I more Venezuelan than American? And before I joined HLSU, I really didn't not that I didn't accept that I was Hispanic or Latina. Mm-hmm. It's just that I didn't really connect with it as much as I do now. Yeah, it was
That's
really
great.
It was really great. It helped me really appreciate my culture a lot more, and it really helped me accept that I was Hispanic and love that about myself. So if you are of Hispanic descent, or if you are Hispanic or Latino, I really encourage you as a student to join HLSU because it really helped you. It really helped me really explore that side of my identity and really accept that and appreciate that a lot more.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, so I've got a similar story. Like Maria came at the age of 10, and I think I just crossed my 11-year border. So I guess now I'm like, am I really more like, I don't know. I just
But
like,
I still feel
and
more.
You just became a United States citizen.
And I just became a citizen.
That's great.
So it's kind of I'm not 100% sure, you know, like what it was or what it is to consider myself, especially if you tend to go back home to your, I guess, your home country, go back to Ecuador a lot, you'll notice that you're not really from there or from here. You're you're creating a new identity to a point, because your cousin, every family will say, like, you know, you're now a U.S. citizen. You're something else. But I mean, really, it is something new, because you're really adapting to both, and you're taking like, I guess you would say, identities from both cultures that you that you like.
And that's something we tapped into this past year with Hispanic Heritage Month. Our theme was, what's your hyphen? And understanding that we are both. We are, for example, in my case, I'm Venezuelan American. And, and accepting that. And I think we really focus on that this year and making sure that we are both. We are both Hispanic, but we're also American. And I think a lot of students don't understand that. And I think a lot of students struggle with that identity.
And I think that, you know, that's important, because you look at biracial, and biracial children are often forced to play, to check one or the other. And they're just as much black as they are white, you know? And so you shouldn't be forced, you know? I mean, that's at least the way that I'm looking at it. You look like you wanted to say something.
No, I completely agree.
Okay. It's just like, why are we, you know, like, denominating stuff like that? It's just to a point, I think that nowadays we're in a point in time where, where we're at, I don't know, where we're moving towards. It's just, I think that we can have much more similarities, and I think our socioeconomic standings really, like, define more about, I think before, when it was used to be used, it was about to define, like, in a census, define where you at or what type of life you lived. I think that now, if we use it in that sense, I think socioeconomic statuses would probably, like, apply just as well. Because I think, like, when we look at the Hispanic Latino community, we are different as far as the cultures that we bring in, but at the same time, we can relate in so many ways to many other cultures that are minorities within the American population.
Now, three of you are from either Ecuador, Venezuela, but Alejandro, you have been you were born here.
Correct, yeah.
Okay. Is there a distinction that's made between that?
Being born here in the United States, for me, it's funny. I have two older siblings and a younger sibling. My two older siblings were born in Mexico. And me and my younger sister were born in the United States. And I've always grew up with this notion, like my brother would always say, you know, you're not Mexican enough, or, you know, you have, you're not really Mexican. And I always grew up with that notion in my mind, thinking, well, I'm not really that, you know, until I came to Florida State, until I did meet people who were like-minded, who also explored their identity as well. And I'm proud to say now I'm Mexican-American, you know, completely. And I embrace that title. I embrace whatever that is. And, yeah, I mean, I guess it's not too different. But, yeah, that's kind of where my story came from.
Okay. Well, now, do any of you have illegal family members who are here illegally, or have you experienced that? Because, you know, that's something we hear about so much. And so I got to ask, because I want to know.
Yeah, actually, I forgot. I do. I have an uncle that's here, and he's undocumented. I don't like to use the term illegal, because it just...
Well, but it's the term, you know. It's the term that kind of makes the distinction. So that's, you know, that's why I used it. Okay. How do they handle that? I mean, what are they?
It's very difficult, because, first of all, living is difficult. Finding a job is difficult. Driving is difficult. Getting to work is difficult. So it's definitely it's just hard for him to live here. And I think the laws make it even that much harder for him to even try to change his status, if that makes sense.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And as you look at the laws, why do you think, what's your opinion, what's your reading on them? And when I say reading on them, as far as the difficulty that they raise, how do you interpret that?
I think one of the main problems is that the people who make a lot of these laws have not walked these shoes. That it's a mindset that is different and foreign. And so the struggles that we faced are completely different, and those laws are being made from a different perspective, or a very limited perspective. So I think one of the biggest issues for – I mean, from where I come from, which I'm very involved politically, is political representation of our own people. People getting involved in the process and changing it so that the people who are making the laws are not biased in the sense that they have no idea what's going on in the community, mm-hmm. where they are struggling to eat the next day, or they're mm-hmm. figuring out, well, maybe I shouldn't drive because I don't have a license, you know. So when those struggles are, you know, on a daily basis for those people have to get involved in the political process.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Comment?
No, I agree completely. Yeah, I think that those people who are making those decisions need to be people that are facing those struggles and those issues themselves.
Yeah. Well, it's sort of like when you look at the whole issue with gay mm-hmm. individuals. People were vehemently against it. But then someone's son comes out. Mm-hmm. And all of a sudden, they change. Have you noticed that? They change their position. Mm-hmm. So they just need to marry a Hispanic or a Latino.
Yeah. I mean, and it needs to affect them.
Right. Yeah. And their whole position changes. Yes. I mean, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And truly be open-minded about it, too. Because, mm-hmm. I've also experienced people, especially in politics, that will say, you know, oh, I related to this person or like, oh, I was born of this person, but when it comes to policy, you will not do anything about it. Like, I mean, I guess it's also like having a little courage about saying that if you really represent something from this area, that you're also understanding about it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. As you look at the struggles of the Hispanic Latino population, what would you identify as some of the really salient struggles that you all encounter?
I think me personally is being a Latino woman. At FSU, Latino women have the highest dropout rates right now at FSU, one of the highest. And I think it's very difficult because I think you're dealing with both the social aspect of it and like your family believing one thing and then you wanting to do something else and get a career, but you still have people like kind of holding you back because mm-hmm. They have this mindset of what you should be, especially in a culture that's so I don't want to say sexist, but in a culture that's very much about women should be family mm-hmm. and home and housewives. Mm-hmm. It's hard. It's difficult to deal with that. And kind of like my parents are very supportive, but it's difficult when you go back to your home country and your family's like, oh, so you don't want to have kids? Why? You know, so that's something that I struggle with.
You can't do one.
Yeah, exactly.
All right.
So I think that's something that I struggle with and trying to help other women understand that just because you're Hispanic, you don't have to fit into that stereotype.
And that I would think that'd be really difficult because you're breaking, you know, a tradition, mm-hmm. so to speak, and a mindset that has been, you know,
drilled.
I think one of the other issues of this story I heard a lot when I first moved here to Tallahassee. And it stuck with me.
I tell you what, before you go on your story, so I won't have to interrupt you, we're going to take a break. You tuned in to 411 Teen. This is a fantastic program. I want to say thanks to all my panelists. We are talking about Hispanic Latino issues. We're going to take a brief break, but we'll get right back at you. If you're just tuning in, the program is 411 Teen, and we are talking about Hispanic Latino issues. Alejandro, I had to interrupt you, so
not
now you can continue
not a problem.
With
not
your
a
story.
Problem. Yeah. Okay. I was just going to say a story that I first heard when I got to Tallahassee of the Hispanic issues. I guess in a way, kind of haunted me, and realized that this is what I need to be doing and fighting for these.
Mm-hmm.
It was this lady. I guess she had gotten raped in this area. And she was undocumented and was fearful to call the police to mm-hmm. report any incident and instead went to, you know, a friend of hers. For me, knowing that that took place in our own backyard here, knowing that it took place here, knowing that that is something that is prevalent, really scared me and shocked me and said, well, you know, there's a big issue here. You know, if mm-hmm. a woman can't go safely to, you know, and I'm sure, you know, this was a few years ago, but still it's something
that's an ongoing issue.
Yeah, all over the United States.
Because not just whether it's rape, just any violation, you feel like you can't report it. And you have that right to be able to report it. But then you worry about the ramifications of if you report it.
On the same like note, I mean, there is a whole human trafficking, especially here in Tallahassee, human trafficking like scandal. It has been in the past, you know, with the fact of people bring people here, and you know, in some way or another, like basically used as sex slaves, and they're used brought from Latin America. So it's just kind of a you know, there's so many issues behind that, and it is just kind of like terrifying to see that, you know. Sometimes the stories don't get into ground. Don't even get any attention.
Yeah,
and that's the biggest problem. Is like if they don't get any attention, nothing's going to happen to them. They're just going to remain the same, and it's going to just keep increasing.
It keeps
yeah, and I think the craziest thing about it is that it happens here. You know, I mean, I mean, Tallahassee is not the most Hispanic location in the United States. I mean, it's roughly about 7%. You know, but it can happen everywhere, you know, and that's the scary part, I think, is, you know, immigration's important. It's a topic we all will be discussing later, but there are so many more that plague the Hispanic issues.
Yeah, and I think for us as students, the important part is to talk about those issues and share that with not just FSU community, but with the Tallahassee community as well. Like you said, there's 6% in Tallahassee of Hispanic community, but in the FSU community, I think we're like 17%.
Oh, really?
Yeah, so we're a big group. Yeah, so I think our job as students and as student leaders is to really bring those topics to light.
And if I can just chime in, going back to the HLSU, Hispanic Latino Student Union, they do fantastic programming throughout the year on issues that, you know, we're talking about right now. There have been panel discussions, all of this. So I just want to make another plug. They're fantastic, you know. So
share with us some of the kind of things that you have addressed.
I was the political action committee the chair of the committee this past year. And one thing the committee focuses on is doing something called El Centro Dialogues, which is a dialogue talk type of event where we address an issue. And one of them was more of social aspects that are affecting Hispanics in the way that it just affects Hispanics. There was LGBTQ rights and immigration, of course, and government politics and all that. And then we did a more it was just an open talk and, you know, talking about the issues and how they need to be fixed and how they can be addressed. And obviously everyone has different viewpoints. We all don't share the same beliefs. We all don't share the same customs, even though we're Hispanics. But so it's really fun how we come together, and it's really cool how we come together and voice our opinion in a safe zone.
Yeah.
So that's what HLSU offers, and that's what one of the programs that we do.
And we even talked about like religion and how different religion can be in each of our own countries. And I think that was really interesting because you didn't really get to have a lot of those talks.
I'm smiling at you because that was my next thing I was going to ask you about. It's just, you know, religion and how you address it. And I think, well, and it's the same kind of thing you see with all people of color. You know, brown people are all the same. Black folks are all the same. I mean, that's the attitude that the masses have, you know. And how do you deal with religion, I mean, as a group, you know, where you all are coming from different perspectives or different religions? How is that addressed in your group?
Yeah, I think the best part about HLSU is that we are a very open group, and we are all friends. I think we really focus on creating that community style of an organization. So we are very open to new ideas and to other people's perspectives. I think that really helps in the conversation and guiding the conversation and having really open conversations, especially in things like a Centro Dialogues. But yeah, we are all very different. Even in countries where people share the same religion, they're just completely different. And I think it's important for us to educate other people and make them understand that just because we are considered Hispanic or Latino, it doesn't mean that we are all the same.
Yeah. Let's look at health issues. Are there particular health issues that plague the Hispanic Latino culture, ethnicity? I mean, for example, I think I was reading, asthma is an issue. Cancer is an issue. Diet, obesity are issues. So that's what I'm talking about. And how are they addressed?
Well, it's funny. There is a poll that came out about a few weeks ago in the state of Florida for Hispanics in the state of Florida. And it was on what are the top priority issues for Hispanics, you know? And the first perception, maybe immigration may be on top, but it's not. Number one is believed to be education. Number two, healthcare. Number three, jobs. Number four came the economy. And then number five, immigration. So the healthcare issue is a huge, you know, and so maybe – I don't know off the top of my head any, like, healthcare issue that is – but I think the whole system itself is a big problem.
Well, it's a huge problem because Hispanic immigrants are just not – they just can't afford healthcare. I know for me personally, the first time I had any kind of healthcare was when I came into Florida State because I had to get it because I was forced to get it. But my family doesn't have healthcare. My sister does, thankfully, because she was born in this country. But none of my family members have ever had any type of healthcare.
And that's also like a culture shock, I would say, because, I mean, back in our countries, the way that I remember it, you know, how healthcare used to be ran, it was like, at least in Ecuador, it's more of like, well, it's way cheaper to begin with, you know, it's depending on the type of issue. But day-to-day care is something that you could do easier than you can do here if you just have the tools.
Like preventative care.
Preventative care, exactly. So now getting here to the U.S., it's just you look at the prices and you're like a family that just, you know, moved. Can't afford that. Can't
like,
afford that at all.
Even I know from my personal experience, even going to the dentist, like my dad, he wouldn't go to the dentist because it was so expensive. So he would just deal with the pain for 4 months. And it's crazy to think about that. But that's a lot of things that Hispanic families are dealing with. And health issues is a big one.
Yeah. And when we joke around, maybe at least my family being like, oh, you know, you have this wrong right now. You're not going to the doctor. You know, there's that stubbornness. But I think underneath that stubbornness is really that truth of, well, really, am I going to spend $60 for a visit to check my leg, or am I going to spend those $60 on food for the next week? And I think those are the issues that we struggle with as a community too.
And then next thing I would say is food too. Getting back to the point that, you know, we do have families that are working two jobs, three jobs, whatever is necessary to, you know, make the ends meet, and is both of the parents working, you know, how is it that we're able to really get nutritious things for the parents and also for the kids? You know, like, when is the time to cook a healthy meal? And what are the prices of healthy meals?
I was just going to say, you know, if we go according to what nutritionists say, it costs a lot of money to buy the items that they identify as healthy. You know, so how do you address that? What do you do? And that's not just for Hispanics. I mean, you know,
And something's really funny because when we moved into this country, my mom, she was a stay-at-home mom in Venezuela, and she used to cook lunch for us every day at 12 o'clock when I got home from school. And we moved to this country, and we said we're never going to have frozen meals. And 9 years down the road, my fridge is full with pizzas and all kinds of frozen meals. But it's just – it's so much easier because my mom works from 8 in the morning to 6. She gets home. She's exhausted. There was a point when she had to go back to work at 9 to 2 in the morning. So it was just impossible for her to make any sort of meals. And my dad changed a lot, too. He now cooks a lot more. In Venezuela, he didn't really used to cook. But it's just that it's harder. It's harder for families who are working all the time to provide healthy meals for themselves and for their kids.
And to be healthy, because I think you give me the example about your mom and her work schedule. You know, they're always talking about how important exercise is. Well, if you work all day and then you come back, exercise is not a high priority.
Your job most likely is taking care of the exercise.
It's funny you mention that because I just got off the phone with my mother not too long ago, and one of the first things she told me was, "I'm debating whether to exercise or not, or to sleep because I haven't slept in a while." You know, and that's exactly the issue.
And that's exactly the issue. What about housing? Housing is something that's often identified, you know, as an issue. Okay, and I just want to get your feed on housing. Is housing the issue that we hear it is
I think it depends on it really depends on the case.
Okay.
Obviously, it's more it affects mostly Hispanics because we are kind of the people that kind of – it's not a stereotype, but it is what people see as, oh, yeah, it is going to affect Hispanics. They're going to live in this lower income area or they're going to live in this other area. Mm-hmm. But it would really be a situation base for the most part, which is what one thing that we discussed at the dialogues that HLSU does is – once we come to this country, we blend in. We feel like we blend in. As Hispanics, we blend in with the culture. But a normal American, white American, sees us as Hispanics.
Right.
While we – I don't see – I obviously know I'm Hispanic and they're white, but I don't see any, like,
major
difference.
You don't see
I don't see a –
Right.
You know, any...
Might be a little more tan.
That's right. Yeah. No, I mean, but because it really believe it or not, I got cousins that look like y'all.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. You know what I mean? Yeah. So, I mean, and they can make the distinction. They meaning, you know, the dominant culture. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, if the skin color is a little bit different, you know?
Yeah, and I think going back to the housing... the Hispanic and Latino population are moving throughout the United States in a rapid pace because they're looking for better living conditions. They're looking for more opportunities in certain states. And the crazy part is each state does their own laws, you know.
Exactly.
Which so what was convenient for South, you know, Alabama, Georgia, all of these areas for Hispanics before and the laws have changed, they're moving more now into, you know, North Florida. So I think – it all depends on certain regional housing issues. Mm-hmm. I think it falls on region.
And you know, I don't want to mention too much the topic, but it also depends on, like, the reason why people came, too. Like, usually, you know, if you came for, like, farming or something like that, that's where I think most of the problems with housing come to be as well.
Okay.
Because with jobs as farming, you literally probably doing something like – crossing the border, farming, and coming back. So you don't really, you're not really looking for like a place to stay for like a large amount of time. Mm-hmm. So it depends, and you know,
it's kind of transient.
Yeah, it depends,
and it affects a lot of the younger people. And so, for example, I know a lot of families in North Florida. For example, a lot of migrant farm working families that move from place to place depending on the season of the crops, etc. And these children are having to move as well, having a tough time staying, you know, academically competitive. Which is another issue all within itself that we all are very passionate about.
Mm-hmm. Education.
Yeah, big one.
Yeah, that is a very big one. Yeah. You know, and like you said, those are the kids who are most affected by it, the ones where the family is transient and they're moving here and they aren't in the school long enough to, you know, to really get a feel for the school. Before that, they got to move again.
And it's harder within itself to be an immigrant student and coming into a school. So just having to move again and again and not really having that time to form that group of friends or to adjust to one specific school, I think that's very difficult on a student that's just coming into this country.
Yeah. Before we take our break, do you have any suggestions for students who may be in that situation that may help them in the transition, in the adjustment?
I mean,
I would say, first of all, like, you're not alone.
Exactly. Yeah.
You're not alone.
Look for mentors.
Just know that you have people around you that are, they're probably, you know, first of all, your family that cares very much about you, because there seems to be like a disconnect sometimes from like how much time you spend with your family. But they're going through the same struggle as you are. And then you have a community, maybe HLSU or other like Hispanic associations that are there for that same reason, to provide some type of aid at the end of the day that these people need, that we need, you know, overall.
And the help is out there, but I feel like it's not advertised enough. So I think also like just looking out for things that will help you and just finding that community and finding those people that you can talk to about your issues.
Okay. Well, we're going to take a break, but we'll return momentarily. If you're just tuning in, the program is 411 Teen. We're examining issues in the Hispanic Latino community. Immigration reform is a major issue for this community. It's vaulted to the top of the agenda in Washington. After years of fighting, nearly everyone agrees the system is broken. President Obama has made immigration reform a priority. Let's talk about immigration reform. I know we could have done the whole program on this, and I'll have to get you back, and we will devote the whole program. But what is your position, and I say that to each one of you, on immigration reform? And I'll start with whomever wants to start.
One of the things that I would say, just with my knowledge of the topic, is that it affects us. This is what we were talking about earlier, and that's how we know it affects us. It affects our families, our friends, and sometimes, you know, even ourselves. Mm-hmm. And that's what people don't understand until it affects them, especially the normal American person. They don't know that it takes this amount of time, it takes this amount of money to become, you know, receive a green card and then receive citizenship in this country. It takes a while. It's a long process, and it's tedious. It is expensive. And people, since it doesn't affect them, they just think it's easy. They really don't know the process.
They think anybody can become a citizen in a day, and that's not the case. It took me 7 years to just become a permanent resident after my family was basically cheated on. The first lawyer we worked with stole about $10,000 from us, and then we had to start all over again. So it was like a year and a half that was just completely wasted, waste of money, waste of time. And then we had to start from zero again. And being here, already struggling to find a job, struggling to find a place to stay, I just feel like a lot of people just don't understand what it really takes to become a citizen.
Mm-hmm. And you hear from Maria and Jorge how difficult it is. And the bill that just came up to the Senate, the United States Senate, from the Gang of Eight, If I'm correct, Marco Rubio, the senator from Florida, said recently that this bill would make it harder to become a citizen. And you already see the difficulties that there are here. Mm-hmm. You already see the difficulties. So, for example, the money being an issue.
Yes.
And we mentioned it earlier.
Well, let's talk about the money. Tell the listening audience.
So, from my understanding, you would become a certain status for about 10 years. And to apply for that certain status through this new immigration bill that's up being debated, costs roughly, I think, $700 to $900, and I'm not sure on the exact thing. Mm-hmm. But that's still, when you're talking about in the high hundreds, it's a lot of money for
a family of five or six.
Correct, yeah. You prioritize your children, essentially, in that sense. You know? So then you have that. Then after that 10-year period, I believe – then you apply for, you know, your green card or whatever, you know, documentation is given to you, and that costs roughly in the thousand there. So a rough estimation.
What I hear is they're setting it up so you can't win.
Correct, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. You know?
I'm used to those kind of
things. So that deters people from actually coming.
Yeah. It deters people from coming, and also those families who are here who are you know, it can barely get through the years.
They won't be applying because they can't afford it.
They can't afford it.
And when you're getting paid minimal wage and you have five mouths to feed, it's hard.
Yeah.
It's hard.
And so then go back to the idea of these people who are making these laws have not walked these shoes or have not been in the struggle of that. So, yes, making a bill being $800 is one thing. But when $800 is the most you can make in weeks, that's a lot of big problem.
Mm-hmm. You just went through and you just became a citizen. Can you kind of walk us through it, you see?
Let's talk about first, before I came here, I overstayed my visa, my tourist visa to begin with, and I was not a citizen overall, or far from it. I was, undocumented. My parents had gone through divorce. I'm not going to get too much into problems, socioeconomic problems. But anyways, my mom had gotten married with this new guy. And through it, I was able to get my citizenship because I was underage still. I was 18 years old. And this is going to a topic that we want to talk about as well. But I was under 18, so my mom asked for my papers as well. And I ended up getting it. It takes a process. First, you become a resident, and it's really – if you're over 18, you have to wait a 5-year period to apply for your citizenship. And once you apply, you know, they have requirements they ask you for, like tax records, stuff like that, which is, you know, normal.
You wouldn't have had anything like
that. I didn't have any at that time because, right, you know, I was just a minor, yeah, you know, becoming somebody of age. But that was basically it. But it was very, very extensive. It was a lot of money that I didn't have, my parents didn't have. So I just have to, like, you know, whatever I could use from, like, I had saved up and just made it work. I think that it was about making it work, but not everybody's in those shoes has those, mm-hmm, those capacities. Mm-hmm. I think I was very blessed in many ways to be able to be there. And to be specific, my brother, he was over 18 by the time that my mom had gotten married, and he didn't apply for that. He wasn't able to. My mom wasn't able to ask for him. So the process for him till this day, when did we begin this process? I think I moved. It was over 10 years that he's been undocumented, and, you know, it's just, mm-hmm, like
unfortunate.
It's just kind of like how and when we talk about this migration policies that used to exist before, or these ideas to become policies, which was about to just deport everybody. You know, like, what are you doing to a family? What mm-hmm. type of effects does that have on a family? Mm-hmm. And it's just not something that also is not very considered by the policymakers.
And even right now at the current bill. That's up being debated at the Senate, mm-hmm. Has a cutoff date. If you got here before 2011, mm-hmm. you can stay. If you came here after 2011, that's 2 years roughly period, mm-hmm. you have to go back to your country, which is roughly a few hundred thousand people or so, that families, people like that, who have to just pick up their things and get out of this country.
Yeah, what do you say? Self-deport.
Self-deport,
yeah. And something for me, my family applied for a political asylum because of all the issues that were going on mm-hmm. in Venezuela. And if you know anything about Venezuela right now, you can see that it's a mess.
Yeah.
So for us, when we became residents, it was everything very unsure. At any point, we could have been deported. And the things that can do to a person living with so much uncertainty. My family went through a lot of, like, depression, and the first time I went to court, it got denied, and that was just one of the most horrible moments of my life. Mm-hmm. My mom went through a really tough time. It was really hard for her. And me, as a 12-year-old or 13-year-old, having to put all that much pressure on me and having to feel like, I don't know, like, I had to carry that at such a young age. It's really hard for a family to deal with that. Mm-hmm. And the way they treat you at court is very degrading in a way. That's the way I felt. Mm-hmm. It's just very degrading, and they make you feel like you are illegal. And mm-hmm. but illegal, you're a criminal.
You're a criminal. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But then thankfully the second time we appealed and it got approved. And then we had to wait 5 years to apply to be a citizen, and that's like a lot more money, and we had to take this test. And funny thing, my parents don't know any English. so that's just something else, because they work day and night, and they don't have time to study and to learn English. So that's another issue that comes up.
Or driver's license, especially here in Florida. It's so, like, important to be able to, like, if you want to work, you need to be able to move in some mm-hmm. sort of transportation. And public transportation is not going to cut it, especially here in Florida.
Mm-hmm. No. Yeah. No.
So my brother has gotten stopped so many times, you know, because of, like, small things. Like, oh, like, his light.
His tail light.
His tail light was off. And at this point, he cannot drive anymore. How is he going to be able to perform a job? The ferryman, thank God, came very recently. Now he's being able to you know, move around a little more with the they give you a permit to be able to do something like that. But it's just still, like, you know, you're making it an impossible system mm-hmm, for mm-hmm. people to mm-hmm. leave.
Yeah,
I mean, it's designed that way.
Similar.
And with the driving issue, for example, other states have done it. Other states have allowed undocumented people to receive driver's licenses for a public safety. You know, you have mm-hmm. people there who have not taken a driver's test, who maybe don't know the roads or the rules, safety. And second, there is money, an economical incentive, you know, mm-hmm. for the government to receive these, you know, mm-hmm. these license fees Indeed. And all of that stuff. So the common sense is there, and why it's not being done, especially in this state of, you know, the state of Florida, is beyond me.
Yeah. And also, I have a similar story with my uncle. I said that he's here undocumented, and he got stopped because he didn't have his license, and he actually went to jail for about a week. It was a year ago. and just because he didn't have his license. And that was...
And what does that accomplish?
Nothing. Mm-hmm. And that's going to be in his record for forever.
Right.
So then if he's ever able to get that, then that's going to be against his favor, you mm-hmm. know? So mm-hmm. it's just so many things that are just trying to stop you from becoming legal.
And I think being the students that we are, being privileged enough to be at Florida State, even though mm-hmm. it is a mm-hmm. struggle, and we have... There is so much riding on our, you know, our back mm-hmm. As students who have the privilege to be here to receive that education. And I think none of us take it for granted, mm-hmm. you know, and we know every day is a struggle. And I mm-hmm. think that's really important mm-hmm. for us.
Yeah, because somebody at home, your family, everybody is counting on you, mm-hmm. I would think. You know, you're that hope.
Yeah.
I'm about to graduate and senioritis, I guess you call it, and you're kind of like done. But every time that I'm thinking about, like, you know, I have to give up or like I want to, you know, just take a break,
right.
I think about like family again. Like, mm-hmm. I'm not doing this for myself.
Mm-hmm.
I'm doing this for everybody else mm-hmm. that my brother specifically that was not able to do this.
Mm-hmm.
And that's like a motivator because of the privilege that we've been given. But at the same time, it's, you know, a statement of the fact that it's not like this for everybody. And for the majority, it's not. How many of your friends didn't make it to college mm-hmm. because of the economic problems, because they were illegal? And mm-hmm. that's something that, unfortunately, is the system.
I think one of the saddest things I've experienced working, mentoring at Gabi is I had a student that I was mentoring, and she was brilliant. She was brilliant. She played sports, and she did all extracurricular stuff. And she asked me, oh, I really want to go to Florida State, but I'm undocumented. And I just didn't know what to say. I just, because there's nothing I can say to them, because there's just no opportunity. They have to pay full, like as an international student. And these students just, they cannot afford that. They can't afford.
That's
and
triple,
without FAFSA.
Triple the tuition, an international student.
And without FAFSA, without scholarships, it's impossible. Impossible.
Which leads me to the DREAM Act.
Hmm.
I mean, what's your position on the DREAM Act, as if I don't know?
It needs to happen. Like, when are we going to stop letting such brilliant students that just want to be here to study just like we do? It's ridiculous. It makes me so upset to see so many amazing people just be told that you can't. That you just can't, just because your parents made this decision to better your life. And then they get here, and they can't do that.
Especially,
so it's a waste of time for their parents, a waste of time for them, and it's just really sad.
Especially those people that identify more with the American mm-hmm. culture, mm-hmm. The people that moved here when they're 4 or 5 years old.
Right.
And now they're 16, 17, 18, about to finish high school, and you know, they consider themselves more American. They were raised in this country. They barely remember the country they were born in.
Mm-hmm. They say the Pledge of Allegiance every day.
They say the Pledge of Allegiance every day, and they could not. They cannot attend an institution, even though they can be a straight A student.
But they're losing all these resources.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Yeah.
It's economical. It's common sense. I think what also bothers me, I go back to these lawmakers, mm-hmm. is that other states, because the DREAM Act didn't pass at the national level, other states have taken it on to do it themselves, have taken on the responsibility to make it maybe a state issue. And Florida hasn't gotten there yet. And mm-hmm. being one of the largest, you know, mm-hmm. besides Texas and California, being one of the largest, you know, states of Hispanic, you know, youth, brilliant minds, why it's not being done is beyond me.
Mm-hmm.
Really? Why do you all think it's not being done?
I think it's I'll say this, like call to action. You know, like it's a call to action for the people that are most, you know, attentive about this, us, like, you know, mm-hmm. College students that are able to make a change about this, that are able to in some way or another, like, make a political movement. It's sad when we see dreamers. It's sad, but at the same time, it's uplifting because mm-hmm. they, to a point, you know, they are sticking their guts, especially before the deferred action passed. They were, like, really sticking their guts by being able to put themselves out there and say, this is the problems that are affecting us, and I'm one of them.
Mm-hmm.
Can you help me?
That takes so much courage, too.
Mm-hmm.
And believe it or not, we have so many students at Florida State that are undocumented. And
oh, really?
It's not talked about, but there are plenty of students that are undocumented that go to Florida State. And I understand if they don't want to talk about it because it takes a lot of courage for a student to say that. But if you're interested in learning more about that, you can actually get in contact with AIR. They are Advocates for Immigrant and Refugee Rights. They're an organization on campus, and they work a lot with immigrant and especially the DREAM Act And they actually had an event a couple months ago where they had students share their story of when they were undocumented. So they're a really great organization, and we're hopefully going to program more with them next year.
Wow. Well, Evan just gave me the signal that I have 2 minutes left. So in these last 2 minutes, are there any points that you want to make, any comments you want to make? And you have to come back.
Yes. Okay. Yes.
Really.
I just really want to tell Florida State students to get out there and to really, really fight for these rights, because we have to. If we don't do it, nobody else is going to do it for us. And I think us as college students, we have to be the voice for those students who can't be here and who can't be getting an education like we are. We have to realize that we're very privileged and that it is our duty to fight for those students and to give them the same rights.
For me, I definitely get involved not only on your campus, but also in your community, Tallahassee, Leon County. Mm-hmm. I'm vice president of the Leon County Hispanic Democratic Caucus, and that type of organization is your hands-on experience in the community as well.
Okay. Right. Yeah, one of the things that I would say to people is that definitely research. Like I said, people don't know, they aren't aware of the issues because it doesn't affect them, so they really don't care. So I would say research, look at different sites and programs that are trying to be put into effect that will benefit this country, not just hinder it in any way.
Jesse?
Same thing, just open up and bring a friend with you, somebody that might not have experienced this because they will soon realize.
Well, I just want to say thank you, genuinely,
thank you.
For just sharing all this information. To my listening audience, tune in next week, same time, same place, to get the 411 on 411 Team. This edition of 411 Team was produced by Dr. Liz Hollyfield. Technical engineer, Evan Rossi. Audio copies are available, and if you would like to participate in 411 Team or have topic suggestions, call 1-800-829-8809, extension 358. That's 1-800-829-8809, extension 358. If you would like to subscribe to 411 Team podcast, log in wfsu.org.